Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. U.S. officials bury global warming. Trump's anti-immigrant program puts the Constitution in danger. And Israel's attacks on Gaza break the ceasefire. First, U.S. officials bury global warming and environmental protection. Chris Wright, the new energy secretary and former fracking executive who calls himself a climate realist, told oil and gas executives at a swanky conference that charged $10,000 a ticket, quote, "We are unabashedly pursuing a policy of more American energy production and infrastructure, not less." Wright attacked the Joe Biden administration for focusing, quote, "myopically" on climate change. The Trump administration will end the Biden administration's irrational, quasi-religious policies on climate change that imposed endless sacrifices on our citizens, he said. The cure was far more destructive than the disease. The Trump administration will treat climate change for what it is, a global physical phenomenon that is a side effect of building the modern world, he added. Everything in life involves trade-off. Side effect. The EPA has become the EDA, the Environmental Destruction Agency. Lee Zeldin, administrator of the EPA, has made that abundantly clear. In an almost unbelievable pronouncement, Zeldin said the agency's mission is to, quote, "lower the cost of buying a car, heating a home, and running a business." In other words, not protecting the environment and public health, but deregulating, and at an unprecedented pace. The greatest day of deregulation, he calls it. Gone will be all the air and water pollution laws that define our country's environmental protection, including regulation of greenhouse gases, the legal authority for which Zeldin derided as, quote, "the holy grail of the climate change religion." Moreover, said Zeldin in an internal memo, all 10 regional offices devoted to environmental justice will be closed. Those offices are responsible for protecting low-income communities whose health is threatened by pollution. All this can only be described in one word, criminal. Only public pressure and, presumably, lawsuits stand between Zeldin's plans and environmental catastrophe. And here's a footnote for those who think Bill Gates might be a climate savior. Bill Gates has responded in all the wrong ways, caving in by folding up much of his climate change operation in response to the evisceration of the EPA. His Breakthrough Energy Project will close research operations in the U.S. and other activities abroad. Evidently, he doesn't think Breakthrough will have much influence in Republican-dominated Washington. Strange. The New York Times notes, quote, "Winding down much of the Breakthrough Energy team's work is a sharp reversal for Mr. Gates and reflects a rapidly shifting landscape in politics, philanthropy, climate change, and global development." Trump's anti-immigrant program puts the Constitution in danger. With no regard for legal procedures, the Trump administration is planning to keep many more people from entering the U.S. and removing people it considers dangerous, actions that are directly challenging judicial authority. A draft list of recommendations developed by diplomatic and security officials in the State Department suggests a red list of 11 countries whose citizens would be flatly barred from entering the U.S. They are Afghanistan, Bhutan, Cuba, Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. Then there are 10 countries on the orange list of restricted visas, including Russia and Belarus. 22 more countries are on a yellow list awaiting final determination. These include several African countries and Caribbean countries. Most in common among all the countries listed is that their populations are non-white and poor, and their leaderships corrupt. To some extent, the list repeats Trump's attempted Muslim ban, but now extended. It is uncertain whether travelers on a banned list who already have U.S. visas or green cards may enter the U.S. Russia, a notable inclusion on the yellow list, might be taken off by Trump. Deportations rose to another level with two Trump decisions. First, the arrest of Mahmoud Khalil at Columbia University and the attempt to deport him sets a horrifying precedent. Khalil has a green card, not a student visa, and he did not engage in violence during the pro-Palestinian demonstrations at Columbia. He engaged in political speech, but the government is attempting to remove him on national security grounds. As Trump himself has intimated, it's a test case for deporting non-citizens whom the administration doesn't like. By the way, only 14 of 262 House Democrats signed a petition to free Khalil. The second decision is the deportation of Venezuelan and Salvadoran gang members to El Salvador, whose authoritarian government makes money from incarcerating U.S. prisoners. The basis for the deportation is the Alien Enemies Act, which has only been used in wartime and not since the internment of Japanese citizens during World War II. The deportation took place despite a specific order from a federal judge, who specified that if the prisoners were on a plane, it would have to turn around, since no legal process had preceded their removal. The Trump administration is not only refusing to abide by the judge's request for information in this case, it is directly challenging his authority to preside over it. First, the White House press secretary issued this statement, quote, "A single judge in a single city cannot direct the movement of an aircraft full of foreign alien terrorists who were physically expelled from U.S. soil." The so-called border czar, Tom Homan, was even more aggressive, saying on Fox News, quote, "We're not stopping the deportations. I don't care what the judges think. I don't care what the left thinks. We're coming." An administration lawyer refused multiple times to give the judge information on the exact times that the flights occurred. Finally, Trump weighed in, attacking the judge as a leftist without authority and demanding his removal and impeachment. All this just a day or so after saying it should be illegal to criticize a judge and ruling out impeachment. The outrageous treatment of foreign visitors continues. A Lebanese doctor who works for a nonprofit group affiliated with Brown University was put on a plane to Lebanon by Border and Customs officials in defiance of the judge's order that the court needed 48 hours to consider a deportation. The doctor's lawyer is seeking an order that would return her to the U.S. All these are test cases, not just of the legality of deportations on national security grounds, but also of defiance of a judge's order. We're just a step away from a full-blown constitutional crisis. Israel's attacks on Gaza break the ceasefire. Israel has resumed ferocious attacks on Gaza, killing at least 400 people so far. It seems the aim of the attacks is to move past negotiations into another round of warfare. An unidentified Israeli official said, quote, "Return to fighting in Gaza was fully coordinated with Washington." He added that the U.S.-Israeli alliance was stronger than ever and thanked President Trump and his administration, quote, "for their uncompromising support." Prior to these attacks, Israel was condemned for genocidal acts against women's healthcare facilities in Gaza. A UN report says Israeli security forces have used sexual violence as a weapon of war to, quote, "dominate and destroy the Palestinian people." The 49-page report on sexual and gender-based violence was drawn up by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and presented to the UN Human Rights Council. It details attacks on maternity wards and other healthcare facilities for women, the destruction of an IVF clinic, and controls on the entry of food and medical supplies into Gaza that together, quote, "destroyed in part the reproductive capacity of Palestinians in Gaza as a group, a violation of the Geneva Convention on Genocide." The pattern of sexual violence that Israeli forces used, says the report, including cases of rape and sexualized torture, constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity. The frequency, prevalence, and severity of sexual and gender-based crimes perpetrated across the occupied Palestinian territory leads the Commission to conclude that sexual and gender-based violence is increasingly used as a method of war by Israel to destabilize, dominate, oppress, and destroy the Palestinian people. In other news, Syria's civil war is far from over. Although the Islamist HTS group has cemented power in Syria, opposition to it has not abated. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, a British-based war monitoring group that tracks casualties, reports that around 1,200 people have been killed in the violence, mostly civilians caught in fighting between people loyal to the former dictator, Bashar al-Assad, and fighters loyal to the new government. The violence is mainly in western Syria, home to the Alawite minority that Assad belonged to, and who are now the targets of the reported mass killings. The Associated Press spoke to residents of Alawite villages and towns, who said gunmen carried out revenge killings of Alawites, mostly men, in the streets. They said some homes were looted and set on fire. Syria's interim leader, Ahmed al-Sharaa, addressed the country last week, blaming the violence on people loyal to the old regime, and saying they were trying to test the new Syria by stirring up unrest and fragmentation. He said anyone harming civilians would be held accountable. Interstate violence has also resumed. Syrian forces have attacked Lebanon. Syria has accused Hezbollah of abducting and killing three soldiers. The Syrian regime did get some good news from the Kurds, the Kurdish-led and U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, which controls much of Syria's oil-rich northeast, signed a deal with the Damascus government to join Syria's new state institutions, according to the Syrian presidential office. Next, Ukraine's demographic and refugee crisis. Pre-war, Ukraine's population was around 50 million people. Now, at least 5 million have fled the country, and another 5 million are living under Russian occupation. Today, the population is roughly 36 million, accounting for war deaths. But the even more serious matter, looking ahead, is that if demographic trends continue, Ukraine's population is expected to be around 25 million by mid-century and just 15 million by the year 2100. Ukrainian refugees will no longer be welcome in America. The Trump administration is reportedly planning to revoke the temporary legal status of around 240,000 Ukrainian refugees, part of an effort to strip legal status from more than 1.8 million migrants allowed to enter the U.S. under temporary humanitarian parole programs launched under the Biden administration. Adding to this inhumane decision is the cutting of federal funds for the Humanitarian Research Lab at Yale University, which has helped identify and repatriate over 1,200 Ukrainian children abducted into Russia. Greenland is not for sale. Elections in Greenland last week have sent a clear message to Trump that Greenland is not for sale. Democratic Party leader Jens Frederik Nielsen said, as his party won first place in elections with 30% of the vote, quote, "We don't want to be Americans. No, we don't want to be Danes. We want to be Greenlanders. And we want our own independence in the future. And we want to build our own country by ourselves, not with his hope." Three of the other parties that also want independence all differ somewhat on the timing of declaring independence. Trump has been outspoken about his desire to control Greenland, telling a joint session of Congress last week that he thought the U.S. was going to get it one way or the other. Danish Defense Minister Troels Lund Poulsen congratulated the Democratic Party and said the future Greenlandic government would likely have to deal with massive pressure from U.S. President Donald Trump. He added that, quote, "It's not the case that you can just take part of the Danish realm. The future of Greenland is based on what the Greenlandic people and government want." Indeed. Finally, faced with an unreliable United States, will France and Germany step up to the plate? The French president, who once seemed on the verge of disappearing from the scene, is now in the headlines daily. Emmanuel Macron has gathered European leaders repeatedly in Paris, rushed to Washington and later to London, and generally become the focal point of Europe's struggling effort to stand on its own feet. He is leading the way on two bold ideas that once were dismissed: a European force to support Ukraine, for which he has gotten British, German, and Danish commitments, and a sharing of nuclear weapons protection. Germany's parliament, the Bundestag, has responded to Ukraine's dire situation by passing major increases in its military budget and exempting military spending from a long-standing cap of 1% of GNP. One expert observer says, "If you consider the amount of money Germany is putting there, Germany, a country that is so addicted to a balanced budget, that shows how seriously the incoming coalition is taking the current challenges. This is about survival." The Bundestag also passed an infrastructure bill of over $500 billion. All this comes as the European Commission President, Ursula von der Leyen, presses for a unified European rearmament plan. The Commission, which is the European Union's executive branch, will propose establishing a mechanism for joint purchasing of weapons to help the bloc's 27 nations pool demand and reinforce stocks. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We're on East Burnside. Across from the Jupiter Hotel, nestled in the middle of a block of storefronts, sits a little shop with a bright yellow door. Posters reading, "Humans for a Free Palestine," cover the front window. You have to step closer to see what's inside. It's a flower shop.
Okay, take a look at what we've got. Basically, everyone has chosen chef's choice, so that is good.
We are in my shop and studio, Coy & Co. We're on 8th and Burnside on the east side. I'm Lindsay Coy. I'm the Coy to the Co. Coy & Co. Yeah, that's my name.
A stack of black buckets sits beside a large utility sink in the back of the shop. Nearby shelves are packed with old rags and other odds and ends.
So what are you doing right now? I am washing buckets, which I should have done before you came, but it's got to be done, so here we are. But yes, bucket washing is a very, it is part of doing floristry and farm work. It's an essential part of it. You gotta have clean vessels.
Coy & Co. isn't your average flower shop. There are no fresh flowers when you walk in. Long tables of dried flowers are the first things you see. They're packed full. Little mason jars of flower heads are tucked between bushels of dried long stems. It smells earthy, like sweet musk and herb.
That's one of the things we hear the most when people walk in is like, they'll say, "It smells so good in here." And my response is usually like, "Oh, good. I'm happy to hear that." Because at this point, I'm basically nose blind to it. But when I go, when I'm like out of town for a few days and I come back, I always walk in. I'm like, yep, this is my spot. This is home.
All the fresh flowers are in the back, stored in a refrigerator Lindsay made herself, with a little help from friends. It's a common theme here at Coy & Co. Lindsay put in checkerboard marmoleum flooring. She tells me it's biodegradable. She says she's never purchased a bucket. Everything is reused. Bouquets are wrapped in paper.
Yeah, I've never thrown away a bucket. Even our buckets that like maybe get cracks in them or something, I just use for dried flowers and they get marked with purple tape. But black plastic is really, really, really bad for the environment. And so, you know, maybe I'll just be buried with them. I don't know. But they're never getting thrown away.
The shop is 7 years in the making. Lindsay began selling her flowers at a stand outside of a friend's restaurant in her early 20s. She spent her youth homeless here in Portland and lost her financial aid for college. She was on her own and needed to make a living, so she got together with some fellow artisans. At the beginning, they shared rent for the back part of what is now the Coy & Co. storefront. Now, at 29, she rents the entire store herself.
Once you've kind of hit the bottom of the barrel, once you've lost everything, everything else is kind of a lot easier.
But this isn't the story Lindsay wants to tell.
I think that my story could be really easily used to promote a false narrative of the American dream and bootstrapping it. Like, look, a homeless queer girl like can do it. Why can't you? And it's like, I was able to do it because of all of the barriers I didn't have.
She's more interested in acknowledging her current privileges and using her resources to give back and foster an ethical relationship with the community and the world. Her activism and business choices center those desires.
Our main thing is that we're a sustainable florist. We sell 100% locally grown flowers, no plastics, no dyes, no bleaches, no preservatives. Yeah.
Is that stuff usually in flowers, like dyes,
yes,
and bleaches?
Yes, a lot, a lot.
Okay.
I believe that when you create a business, you're creating a system. So a good friend of mine, Amber, likes to say, be a little harder on the system and a little softer on each other. And I think about that when I think about being a small business owner, because you are creating a system that didn't exist before. It's important to me that the systems that I'm creating are as sustainable as possible. So of course they should be intentional. I also believe that businesses should be responsible for the end life of anything that they bring into the world. So if you're creating, you know, a shoe, you should be responsible for what happens to not just the shoe, but also the packaging that the shoe comes in, like all that stuff, because the customer doesn't get to make that decision. Sure, you get to make a buying choice, but I think it's far more important that businesses are held accountable and taking responsibility for creating something that didn't exist previously.
I asked Lindsay about her posters. She told me that she feels the need to be doubly loud because there's so much silence about Palestine from other businesses around her.
Businesses have always been political spaces. They've always been arbiters of systems. We have some billionaires in power right now that are unelected. Businesses are political no matter what you say, so if you choose to say nothing, that is still a political statement.
She quotes poet June Jordan and Angela Davis, saying, "Palestine is a moral litmus test of the world." She told me later that she fundraises for a friend displaced from Gaza and points to a nonprofit called Al-Ada, the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, a Florida-based organization that supports Palestinian refugees.
I believed when I was first starting out that you could change things through the system that existed. I don't believe that anymore. I believe Baldwin, you can't change the system through the system, at least in my opinion, especially lately. I feel like every day I'm trying to figure out the why, and I do have to try and understand that, because it's really difficult to live in this world, because I just don't understand why not. Every day I'm trying to figure out the answers to these questions. We're humans in the good and the bad way. we're humans.
For KBOO, I'm Anna Wilcox.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Portland will conduct an investigation into its relationship with Zenith Energy. A resolution on the matter passed 11-1 at Wednesday's City Council meeting, with Councillor Steve Novick as the sole no vote. It's a long time in the making, the result of years of public pressure. Zenith Energy has a history of violating state and local laws. Most recently, the company was fined $300,000 for illegally constructing and using a pipeline they didn't have permits for. Here's an excerpt from some of the remarks from Wednesday's City Council meeting from the resolution's co-sponsors, Councillors Mitch Green and Angelita Murillo.
Councillors, when Portlanders voted to change our form of government, they did so on the promise that it would do away with a government structure that was unresponsive to all but the most well-connected Portlanders and not amenable to taking tough questions of accountability, oversight, and transparency head-on. We're in an historic moment where the actions we take or the actions we choose not to take will establish the precedent for this new government for generations to come. So it is with this obligation that I bring forward this resolution with co-sponsors Councillor Murillo, Koyama Lane, and Dunphy, which calls on this body to address a number of issues that are urgent and related to Zenith Energy that present harms to our community, to our city government, and the public trust. So the resolution, I want to highlight what it does. The first element, the meatiest element, calls upon the mayor to exercise his authority and duty given by charter to investigate the franchise agreement that Zenith has with the city. It also demands disclosure of all prior communications between the city and Zenith Energy and to place them in the public record. Third, it demands Portland Permitting and Development to evaluate whether its 2024 Greenway review remains in compliance with land use laws following what we have learned from the DEQ regulatory enforcement action. Vis-a-vis the 2022 LUX. It urges the auditor to investigate the facts and settle the record with respect to competing claims and statements given to council members during the January 21st work session between staff, reporting in the public record, and members of the community. And finally, it demands that the mayor pause any further administrative action to the fullest extent allowed by the law related to Zenith Energy pending the outcome of these investigations. And so I'd like to just take another minute, if I may, to motivate why the franchise agreement aspect of this is so important. The charter grants each incoming mayor both the authority and also the duty to investigate the franchise agreements that the city issues to its franchisees. This is really important because cities grant franchises to private companies that perform inherently public functions, usually with monopoly rights. So this franchise relationship carries with it an essential regulatory obligation that our charter empowers the city with. And so when there's credible evidence that a franchisee has violated that agreement, we have an obligation to act. As the early parts of the resolution lay out, Zenith Energy appears to have violated its franchise agreement by failing to remain in compliance with laws, applicable state and local laws. For example, failing to disclose its unpermitted activities with the city and the DEQ, as well as violating local lobbying rules. So to restore the public trust, we must investigate this franchise agreement. The mayor alone has the authority and the duty to do this. And provide council with the options for remedy if that agreement is found to be in violation. So failure to do so will send a signal to the city, send a signal to the community that the city is unwilling or incapable of exercising its due regulatory authority vested in its charter, and that any company seeking to do business with the privilege of the franchise is beyond account. The other parts of the resolution are designed to restore public trust by addressing issues of accountability, transparency, and inconsistencies in our own policies, and also exclusion of the public from public matters. So at this point, I'd just like to offer, if I may, a moment for my chief co-sponsor, Councilor Murillo, to make some comments as well.
Thank you, Councilor Green, for that introduction. I feel like you laid out all of the policy parts really well, so I just want to take time to thank all the advocates who've worked on this issue for so many years. I'm going to name just a few of you, even though there's a million people that I could probably list here. 350 PDX, Mosquito Fleet, the Linton Ladies, as Councillor Clark affectionately calls them, Columbia River Keeper, the Human Access Project, Breach Collective, Rose City Indivisible, and so many more. The education that you've done for both your community and the way you've empowered your neighbors to act, the way you've armed us as your representatives with information so that we can serve you better, is exactly how our government is supposed to work. We're at a crossroads here. This vote is going to signal how we do business as the city of Portland moving forward, whose voices we prioritize, and if we can stay true to our word. The public deserves transparency. Council also deserves to have all the facts in front of us when we make decisions, especially ones as massive as approving a franchise agreement with an oil company that operates alongside our delicate and sacred ecosystem. The goal of this resolution and this investigation is to give the public transparency, to give council all the facts, and to lay to rest the questions community has had for years about how corporations engage with our government.
That was Portland City Councilors Angelita Murillo and Mitch Green speaking on the resolution to investigate Zenith Energy and its relationship with the city. That resolution passed the council at a vote of 11-1. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.